Welcome. I am incredibly glad you could join us today. We actually have a custom-tailored deep dive ready specifically for you.
Yeah, and today we're turning our attention to grassroots democracy. But we're looking at a very specific and honestly often overlooked aspect of it.
Right. We are looking at how local government actually functions in sprawling urban areas.
It's a massive topic. Our mission for this deep dive is to demystify the incredibly complex machinery that keeps our cities running day in and day out. We are pulling from an extensive educational chapter today. It is densely packed with historical data, a structural breakdown of the governance pyramid, and some really compelling real-world case studies.
Yeah, ultimately, we want to uncover the exact mechanisms that give you, the citizen, a tangible voice in your own backyard.
Exactly.
Okay, let's unpack this. We are constantly inundated with news about national politics, right?
Constantly.
The massive general elections, the high-stakes parliamentary debates, geopolitical maneuvering. That is what dominates the
Yeah,
headline.
it takes up all the oxygen.
But if you stop and think about it, the decisions that most intimately and immediately impact your daily life happen much, much closer to home.
They really do.
We are talking about the quality of your drinking water. We are talking about whether the roads you commute on are paved and safe, or, whether the trucks actually arrive to collect your garbage every morning.
Right. All of that logistical heavy lifting is handled squarely at the local level. It is the absolute bedrock of civil society.
So to really grasp how this machinery operates, it helps to visualize the broader structure of Indian governance as a massive pyramid.
A huge one.
Yeah, at the very apex of that pyramid sits the union government. They handle the big national and international affairs.
Moving down a level from there, you have the state governments. They manage the legislative and administrative needs of their specific regions.
Right.
And then forming the widest, most foundational base of the entire structure, you have the local government. That is the tier operating closest to the ground, interacting with citizens on a daily basis.
So remember this structural fact. The pyramid goes union, state, and then local at the base.
Exactly. Now, anyone who follows local governance knows there's a stark divide between rural and urban administration.
Right, they're totally different beasts.
In rural areas, you have the Panchayati Raj system. You have the Gram Sabha at the village level, moving up to the Zilla Panchayat at the district level.
And that system is designed for agrarian, relatively dispersed populations.
Right. But when you shift your focus to urban areas, when you look at colossal metropolitan hubs like Mumbai, Kolkata, or Chennai, that rural blueprint completely breaks down.
You are dealing with staggering population densities, massive commercial infrastructure, an incredibly diverse transient populace. You simply cannot govern a sprawling megacity using the same administrative tools you would use for a small farming village.
The complexity scales exponentially, which is why urban local bodies are stratified into three distinct tiers. The classification of a city, and therefore the type of local body it gets, is dictated entirely by its population size.
This structural division is crucial for maintaining administrative efficiency.
So let's look at that breakdown, starting with the transitional spaces. The first tier is the Nagar Panchayat.
Right, the Nagar Panchayat.
This is specifically designed for smaller towns that are in a state of flux. They are shedding their rural characteristics and transitioning into urban areas.
They need a governance structure that can handle that specific type of growing pain, like upgrading from dirt village pathways to paved commercial streets.
Exactly. Moving up the scale, the second tier is the municipal council. This is also known as the Nagar Palika.
Nagarpalika, got it.
This tier is designated for established cities with a population ranging between 1 lakh and 10 lakhs.
So we are looking at urban centers with anywhere from 100,000 to 1 million residents.
Right. This requires a robust administrative body capable of managing significant infrastructure and public services.
Remember this key threshold? The municipal council is for populations between 1 and 10 lakhs.
And then we reach the apex of urban local governance. The municipal corporation, also known as the Mahanagar Nigam.
The big ones.
Yes. This third tier is reserved for the truly massive urban agglomerations, cities boasting populations well over 10 lakhs. When you are dealing with millions of people in a concentrated area, the administrative apparatus has to be immense.
But here is the logistical challenge with that. A municipal corporation overseeing 5 million people cannot possibly manage every single broken street lamp or localized drainage issue from a single centralized headquarters.
The bureaucracy would paralyze the city.
To solve this, they implement a system of micromanagement. They divide the city into much smaller, geographically defined units called wards.
Wards. And this is where the concept of decentralization becomes incredibly practical.
Exactly. Each ward has its own dedicated committee. Instead of a resident having to navigate a labyrinthine central bureaucracy at City Hall to address a neighborhood issue, they have a direct, localized point of contact. If there's a sudden issue with waste accumulation on a specific street, the ward committee is there to address it. It brings the power of the municipal corporation right down to the neighborhood level.
The ward committees are incredibly active. They are the ones organizing local health camps or running localized awareness campaigns. Things like initiatives to curb the use of single-use plastics in neighborhood markets.
They act as the sensory organs of the broader municipal body. They detect and respond to granular issues before they escalate into citywide problems.
Exactly. Remember this concept. Megacities are broken down into smaller, manageable wards to keep democracy local.
Looking through the historical data in our sources, the timeline really challenges the assumption that this kind of complex, decentralized urban governance is a modern invention.
It really does.
The history of local democracy here is actually quite deep. The sources trace the origins all the way back to September 29, 1688.
That is a pivotal date in the context of administrative history.
It marks the establishment of the Madras Corporation. We know it today as the Greater Chennai Corporation. Yeah. It was created through a charter issued by the East India Company, making it the oldest municipal institution in the entire country. They essentially drew a boundary 16 kilometers wide around Fort St. George and formalized it as a corporate entity.
What's fascinating here is the evolution of their administrative authority. Just establishing a corporation is one thing. But a local body needs resources to actually govern.
Yes, they need money.
That critical shift happened a century later, in 1792. A parliamentary act was passed that officially granted the Madras Corporation the power to levy municipal taxes.
And according to the text, that 1792 act is when proper functional municipal administration truly began. Remember this date, 1792? Taxes meant actual power.
Without the ability to collect taxes, a municipal body is essentially powerless. Once they had revenue, they could actually build and maintain the city. This model of governance proved so essential that it continued to expand. It led to the creation of the Municipal Corporation of Greater Mumbai in 1865.
Tracing these dates highlights a broader sociological phenomenon. The development of these municipal bodies was not just about organizing street sweepers or collecting property taxes.
No, not at all.
It was fundamentally about the evolution of participatory democracy. It was about creating structured environments where citizens could engage in the process of self-governance.
That concept ties directly into a phenomenal piece of archival text included in the sources. It is a quote from a constituent assembly member named Rustam K. Sidwell.
Ah, yes. He delivered this on October 13th, 1949.
The nation was in the process of defining its democratic future, and Sidwell articulated a profound vision for the role of local government.
I have the quote right here. He stated, "I desire that a full-fledged local body should be immediately formed so that people may know really what is an administration, what are the franchise, what are the powers, what are the rights, and what are the privileges in a small sphere, in their own town, in their own villages."
It is a remarkable articulation of democratic theory. He is explicitly framing local government as the ultimate training ground for citizenship.
The training ground. I love that phrasing.
By operating in that small sphere, individuals learn the mechanics of democracy firsthand. They learn how to exercise their franchise. They learn how to navigate administrative bureaucracy. And most importantly, how to hold elected officials accountable for tangible outcomes.
When you understand that history and that philosophy, it completely reframes how you look at the daily operations of these urban bodies. And to illustrate the sheer volume of what these bodies actually do, the sources provide a detailed breakdown of a citizen relationship management system.
The CRM chart.
Yes, specifically for the Indore Municipal Corporation. The scope of their responsibilities is absolutely staggering.
It is effectively cradle-to-grave governance.
Exactly. On the financial and structural side, they are managing property taxes and water charges. They are responsible for comprehensive solid waste management across the entire city.
Right.
They regulate local commerce by issuing trade licenses. They even control the visual environment by managing the permits for large advertising hoardings.
But then you look at their involvement in the personal and emergency aspects of urban life.
Yes, they are the ones issuing marriage certificates. They operate the city's fire services. When there is an acute resource shortage, they are the ones deploying water tankers to affected neighborhoods.
And clearing debris.
Right. They're responsible for clearing heavy debris after structural failures or storms. They manage the pruning of dangerous trees, operate mobile toilets for public events, book municipal auditoriums, and even dispatch ambulances and funeral vans. They manage the entire physical and logistical reality of the city.
Remember this extensive list of duties. A municipal corporation touches almost every aspect of your daily public life. And when a municipal corporation executes that massive portfolio of responsibilities efficiently, the societal impact is profound.
That brings us to the case study of Indore in Madhya Pradesh.
Under the central government's Swachh Sarvekshan scheme, which evaluates urban sanitation and cleanliness, Indore has consistently been awarded the title of the cleanest city in India.
What stands out in the sources is the longevity of that achievement. Indore hasn't just won the award once or twice. They have held that title for 7 consecutive years.
7 years.
A streak like that requires us to look critically at the cause and effect of urban governance. You do not maintain the status of India's cleanest city for nearly a decade simply by having a well-funded municipal corporation that buys more garbage trucks.
Funding and infrastructure are prerequisites, certainly, but they are not sufficient on their own. If a municipality deploys state-of-the-art waste management vehicles, but the resident population continues to indiscriminately dump refuse in public spaces, the city will remain deeply unsanitary.
The success in Indore implies an incredible level of synergy between the urban local body and the citizens. It requires a fundamental behavioral shift and a deep-seated culture of civic responsibility.
Yes.
It is the practical application of Rustam K. Sidwa's vision. The administration provides the framework, and the citizens actively participate in the maintenance of their sphere.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it underscores a fundamental tenet of democratic society. Rights are inextricably linked to responsibilities. For these massive, complex urban local bodies to function with any degree of efficiency, passive citizenship is not an option.
Active participation is mandatory.
It is a continuous two-way street between the governed and the governing.
The sources outline several practical manifestations of these citizen duties. It extends far beyond the basic obligation of paying property taxes. It involves daily, localized compliance.
Like waste segregation.
Waste segregation is a prime example. The simple act of a household strictly separating wet, biodegradable waste from dry, recyclable waste drastically reduces the logistical burden on municipal sanitation workers. It makes citywide recycling programs viable.
Another crucial duty highlighted in the text is the prompt reporting of infrastructure failures. If a citizen observes a ruptured water main flooding a street, ignoring it assumes that the municipal body is omniscient.
Which they aren't.
Exactly. Reporting that leak immediately to the local ward committee prevents the massive loss of a vital resource. It also mitigates structural damage to the road. It is an act of taking ownership of the shared environment.
Remember this cause and effect. Good services require active citizen participation. Now, to really drive home the sociological differences and how community and civic duty manifest, the authors of the educational chapter use a highly effective narrative device.
A short story?
Yes. They introduce a vignette contrasting two hypothetical children. We have Samir, who lives in a rural village. And we have Anita, who lives in a dense urban center but is currently visiting Samir's village. It is a pedagogical tool designed to highlight the rural-urban divide in civic engagement.
It is a classic sociological comparison. Samir describes a rural experience, emphasizing deep social cohesion. In the village environment, the population is small enough that social bonds are inherently tight. Agricultural labor is often communal, and festivals are celebrated as a collective unit.
The community is highly visible.
And highly integrated.
In contrast, Anita's description of the city highlights the paradox of urban living. The city is defined by immense scale, constant noise, and high-density infrastructure.
Right.
The sheer volume of people paradoxically creates a culture of intense independence and anonymity. It is entirely common in a metropolis to live in an apartment building for years and never learn the names of the people living in the adjacent units.
But the narrative makes a crucial pivot here. It demonstrates that urban anonymity does not equate to a total absence of community. Anita recounts an incident where a period of severe, heavy rainfall caused a house in her neighborhood to structurally fail and collapse.
And in that moment of acute crisis, the urban anonymity completely dissolved. Dozens of people from the surrounding streets, neighbors who otherwise never interacted, immediately converged on the site.
They organically formed a rescue operation, They worked collectively to clear the heavy rubble and ensure no one was trapped in the debris.
The community structure was latent, but it activated instantly when the shared environment was threatened.
During their conversation, Samir questions how local governance factors into such massive urban environments. Anita explains the role of their elected representatives in municipal bodies. This leads Samir to draw a direct parallel to his own rural experience with the Gram Sabha, the village assembly.
He points out that because the village governance structure is so immediate and localized, even the youngest members of the community can directly interact with it. To prove his point to a skeptical Anita, Samir shares a specific, practical example of grassroots intervention.
The electricity wire.
Right. A group of children in the village identified a severe safety hazard. An active electricity wire was hanging dangerously low, nearly making contact with the roof of a local building.
Rather than assuming someone else would handle it, or that they lacked the authority to intervene, the children utilized the local democratic machinery available to them.
They approached a member of their Gram Sabha directly. They not only articulated the hazard, but also proposed a practical solution. They suggested that the electrical post be physically relocated to ensure safe clearance.
And the vital takeaway from the anecdote is that the representative was actually accountable to them. The issue was formally addressed, the post was moved, and the hazard was neutralized.
Remember the story about the wire. It proves that local government listens when you speak up.
That narrative serves as the core thesis of the entire chapter. Whether you are a citizen standing up in a rural Gram Sabha meeting or a resident filing a formal petition with your urban ward committee, the fundamental mechanical principle of the democracy remains identical.
Proactive engagement and raising your voice within the established local framework creates tangible, physical change in your immediate environment.
Let us synthesize everything we have covered in this deep dive. We started by acknowledging that the sheer density and diversity of urban life creates an overwhelming administrative challenge.
To prevent systemic collapse, governance is stratified into a rigid pyramid. Urban local bodies are specifically tailored to population scale.
We have the Nagar Panchayats managing transitional towns. We have the municipal councils running mid-sized cities, all the way up to the massive municipal corporations handling the megacities.
And to maintain a connection to the citizen, those megacities are further fractured into hyper-local wards.
We also explored the exhaustive operational scope of those local bodies. They manage the physical reality of the city, from solid waste and property taxes to emergency services and vital civic documentation.
However, the historical data in the Indore case study both clearly indicate a major caveat. The success of this immense logistical apparatus is entirely contingent upon the active daily participation of the citizenry. The machinery only works if you do your part.
Absolutely. So as you go about your day, pay attention to the urban infrastructure around you. The next time you see a municipal garbage truck executing its route, or you notice a functioning street lamp illuminating an intersection, or you spot a newly issued trade license displayed in the local storefront window, recognize what you're actually looking at.
You are not just seeing city services. You are witnessing the complex, centuries-old machinery of grassroots democracy operating in real time.
Which leaves us with a critical point of reflection regarding our own civic behavior.
I want to bring us back to Rustam K. Sidhwat's profound assertion from 1949. He argued that local government is intentionally designed to be our primary training ground for democratic participation.
Right.
If we accept that premise, it raises a vital question for all of us. If local governance is where we learn to be citizens, how does our personal level of engagement or apathy toward our local ward committee ultimately shape the future of our entire national political landscape?
That is the big question. If we fail to actively practice democracy and hold leaders accountable in our own backyards, it is difficult to expect those democratic principles to miraculously flourish on a national scale. It is a challenging, necessary thought to carry forward.
It absolutely is. Thank you for taking the time to join us on this custom-tailored deep dive. We hope this exploration has given you a much sharper lens through which to view the daily operations of your city. Keep questioning the systems around you, keep actively engaging with your local community, and keep exploring the fascinating mechanics of the world you live in.